The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
Children who have disabilities can face enormous challenges in getting an education. That's why the special education services that have been developed in many of our schools are so important. But how those special ed programs are delivered can make a big difference in the lives of the children. On this edition of UWM Today, we talk with Elise Fratura, Associate Professor of Exceptional Education and Chair of the Department of Exceptional Education at UWM. Elise and others say children with special needs can actually be harmed when they're pulled out of regular classrooms for special ed courses. Welcome, Elise. Good to have you with us today.
Good morning.
So the whole notion of bringing people in the classroom to learn, but then maybe taking them out of the classroom for special training can be problematic.
Well, so here's what we know about it. It's not only problematic. The data that we have right now is achievement scores. The biggest gap is between kids with and without disabilities. And so any marginalized group of kids. So when we look at kids of poverty, kids of race, kids linguistically diverse, and kids with disability who have been pulled out of the general core curriculum actually are the furthest behind in school. So we see the largest achievement gap between those groups of kids.
So tell me how special ed is position today. I mean, I mentioned to you as we were getting ready to go on, years ago when I was in school and special ed was just really being developed or rolled out, the notion then was if you had a special need, you were in a completely separate classroom.
Right.
And there really was no mainstream going on. Have we gotten away from that notion?
Yes and no. In some school districts we have. In the majority of school districts we have not. And we have this thing called response to intervention, which is the acronym is RTI. It's under the Special Ed Federal Act. That's really saying that we have to do an intervention for students prior to receiving special education, but it sets up another tiered system or another pipeline. And so what is happening in our school systems, not only kids with disabilities are being pulled out for instruction, but kids that are perceived to be falling behind are now being pulled out for instruction more and more. And the problem is there's a perception that when we pull out kids for instruction, we can, quote, catch them up or, quote, fix them. And the truth is we're not fixing them. We're not catching them up because the more we pull kids out of the core curriculum, the further behind they become. And the bottom line is they're not getting the core curriculum when they're pulled out. And so we're asking the kids that have the least ability to synthesize information from a variety of different people, a variety of different classrooms, to actually be responsible to do the most synthesis of information. So our kids that are the most capable, in the end, actually get the most comprehensive education in our school system. They don't have to go someplace else to get their needs met. They have instruction that has a beginning and end. They don't get called out. So they have the least fragmented instruction time. So our kids that are pulled out typically have the most fragmented instruction time. We ask them to bring information from someplace else, catch up on information they've missed when they've been out of the core curriculum, and then perform well and not to feel marginalized because they know darn well why they were pulled out. And so we're pulling out a significant number of kids who, and they typically are kids of poverty, kids of color, kids with disability, and kids that are linguistically diverse. So not only do we actually marginalize that entire group of kids? We tell the group that actually remains within the regular ed classrooms that you're the norm. And so it's bigger than just special education being segregated because every other subgroup after special education has followed kind of the medical model that special ed set up when you refer back to when you were in school.
The olden days.
For all of us. So we followed this kind of medical model because the perception was that if a child had a disability, then someone had to have a specialization in that area who could fix that disability. And when they were fixed, they could go back into general ed. You know, and we set up a school system pretty much around a norm group of students. And in our society, in the beginning, so well beyond you and I, it was set up under a very white, male, middle class, upper middle class, kind of dominant society. And we still teach that way. So anybody that actually cannot conform to that norm falls by the wayside. There are school districts that have 30, 40, 50, 60, 70% of their kids labeled, not just disability, but linguistically diverse, at risk, et cetera, labeled for all of those pull-out services.
And those are all special needs. So when we think about special needs, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have some severe learning disability. You may have had something happen in your life that set you back.
Right. Well, it includes a group. So I have to be clear about this because there will be people that will say, no, that you have to meet eligibility for, quote, special education at the federal and state levels. So the state regs mirror the federal regs. And so about 13% of our kids in the state of Wisconsin meet eligibility. Some school districts are higher. Other school districts are lower. The better we actually teach in the core curriculum and the least amount of time we send kids someplace else, not only for their self-esteem, but for comprehensive instruction, the better off we are. And so we really have to invert our system because we have a wait and fail system.
The analogy that comes to my mind is you have these kids who are on the learning train. You pull some of them out of the car and say, go and get some help in the station house over there. But while they're gone, the train moves down the track.
Right.
So they have to come racing up to make up what they missed while they were getting that special assistance.
So the data out there says the kids that are pulled out the most are the furthest behind, and they don't catch up. And so,
it sounds like the intention is good, though, isn't it? Gee, we want to give you something more. We want to help you with something special.
So the intent was good because it was set up on a medical model, and we didn't know any better. But we have decades of data that says we're not getting any better. So we really have to invert the system. I mean, the analogy we use is we put the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff and we wait for the student to fail. And then we run in with sirens and we try to fix and help. And the truth is we're just putting more ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. So we have to invert the system. We have to put the ambulance at the top of the cliff, keep our kids in the core curriculum, and start teaching to a broader norm, not just that kind of white, predominant male, middle-class to upper-class norm that we did that years ago because we wanted to homogenize a group of people. We had immigrants. We had all kinds of people. So when we built public ed, we built it with a very specific intent to homogenize a group of people. And if you didn't fit, you fell by the wayside. And there were some Band-Aids put into place, but it didn't really matter. The school system didn't have to change. It continued to teach to that core group of kids. So now we know that the, quote, new America this time around, we honor diversity. We believe in culturally relevant. We believe that all kids can be successful. And so we have to start teaching to a different norm because there are too many kids that are falling by the wayside. And then we do these kind of artificial things called integration and inclusion, which means, you know, you have to segregate in order to integrate. So the point is, why do we segregate to begin?
I can imagine there may be a parent sitting out there listening to the program who says, I get it. I understand, why the system we have right now may put some of these kids who are pulled out of the classroom for special assistance, put them at a greater disadvantage. But if my kid is doing okay and he's in a class and is ready to keep roaring down that train track, is it going to slow him down or her down if the classroom has students who need extra help, requiring extra time? Does that take away anything from the learning experience for those who are okay?
That's a great question. And parents do ask that all the time. And here's what the research says, that the school systems are as successful as their most challenged student. So when the most challenged student is successful, that means everyone is. So when we look at the data from school districts and we do what we call an equity audit, hundreds and hundreds of school systems. And so when we look at that data, what we clearly see is those school systems that actually teach to a broader range of kids in a very integrated fashion within the core curriculum, all kids do better. The achievement scores go up. So I'll give you an example of Stoughton Public Schools outside of Madison. Stone Public Schools 6 years ago had 18% of their kids met eligibility for special education. And they had a dropout rate, which was odd for kind of a, quote, suburban school district, had a dropout rate of about 15%, 85% of their kids were graduating. Only 76 or something like that percentage of their kids with disabilities were graduating. So they inverted their model, so they're going to put the ambulance on top of the cliff. They're not going to wait for kids to fail. They move their staff. The difference is when you have staff in a variety of different classrooms, they can't build each other's capacity. So I, as a general ed teacher, can't learn to teach a broad range of kids when someone with that expertise is sitting someplace else working with two or three kids. But if they're with me, then we're greater together. So at any rate, they inverted their system so that they had teachers with different expertise teaching together. Their special education rate is down to 9%, which is probably pretty accurate. And their graduation rate is up to 96%. And achievement across the board has increased for all kids. And the gap between kids of poverty, kids of race, different race, and kids linguistically diverse and kids with disabilities has lessened.
So you're actually bringing more resources into that mainstream classroom so that all kids can get what they need individually right. to be successful.
You bring all your staff in, because what we do then is realign the infrastructure of the system all around that core curriculum. Instead of setting up a different model of expertise someplace else, we need the expertise. We certainly need it. So we bring that expertise within to the system, so we're working around all kids. And so those kids that are truly advanced learners, they should keep going. Our job in schools is to help them be the best that they can be. And a student with significant autism, our job is to help them be the best that they can be. But placing a student with significant autism in a classroom with six other kids and then saying their communication goals, and the six other kids may also have communication goals, typically doesn't help them communicate more.
So the modeling is all wrong. They're around people who have some of the right. same problems, and they're not seeing any good right. models that they should use right. as a goal to go after.
Right. And we tend to go back to ability grouping because it's typically our teacher comfort level. So, and it goes back to teaching to a norm. And so school systems ability group a lot. But the truth is, ability grouping is not as effective as cross-ability grouping. And even the most advanced learner is more successful in cross-ability grouping. So Jeannie Oakes does a lot of research on this. There's a tremendous amount of research, especially in the gifted area, that says ability grouping is not as effective as cross-ability.
A little while ago, you said something I want to come back to. You talked about the personal experiences of these kids who have special needs who are pulled out of the classroom. You said they know when they're pulled out that they're different. It highlights or showcases the different and maybe the problems that they have. In what way? How do they know it? Is it a social thing? Do they exhibit frustration or anger at the notion that they are being pulled away from the rest of the class?
Well, let me say it. I'm going to say this from. I had been a high school special ed teacher for years, and then I was a school district administrator, central office administrator for years, and a building principal for years. So before I went to UWM full-time. And so from every single perspective, every lens, whether I was a teacher, and we can all do this from our own experience as a student, but as a teacher, as an administrator, and then working with a variety of school districts, and I probably spend at least a half a day to a couple days a week every week in a school system, someplace, somewhere. And there is no doubt that kids do not want to leave a special education classroom if they understand that they're in it. Leave a special education classroom during the normal passing period because they don't want kids to see them coming out. Truth is, it's no different for kids that are in bilingual segregated programs. So I was in a school outside of Milwaukee, and I was standing in a bilingual classroom, and the bell rang. And I said to the student who was hanging out there, I said, "It's come on, it's time to go. Why aren't you going? What's your next class?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm going to wait a little bit." In perfect English, let me tell you. "I'm going to wait a little bit." And I was like, "Why?" And I thought, "Oh, you silly woman. I know exactly why you're waiting." So I said, "Is it humiliating to you?" He said, "Of course it is." So
he knew very clearly that
everyone knows
he was being called out, spotted out.
Five-year-olds know. Every single everyone knows from 3 years old on, kids know who the adults think belong and who the adults think do not belong. And so not only are we sending all those kids out under kind of the umbrella of helping, we are telling the group that doesn't have to go anywhere that, first of all, they don't know what the criteria is that makes them go someplace else, but they don't want to be in it. So we tell them that who fits the norm and who doesn't fit the norm. So it actually has a greater impact because truth is we send all those kids out into society upon graduation, and everyone that leaves the school system knows who belongs and who doesn't. And we've done research for adults that have had special services and have been pulled out. And to this day, they continue to say, it was humiliating, it was devastating, I had to ride the short bus, it was awful. We've had spouses report that their spouse still cannot get over the damage that it did as far as self-esteem. And so the problem is we keep doing it to a larger group of kids. So it just gets extended. And so we literally know that 20, 30, 40, 50, and we had this conversation in Milwaukee Public Schools yesterday, that could be 70% of the kids graduate from our schools and they don't think they belong to the norm. So when you think about that, what does that do in society? And so what kind of diverse, proactive society do we create when we're sending our student population out there?
And the whole issue of creating a generation of people who lack self-esteem and don't have the confidence to believe that they can be successful.
Right.
You're listening to UWM Today on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Elise Fratura. Elise is an associate professor of exceptional education and also chair of that department at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about ways in which we educate students who have some special needs, and there are some right ways and perhaps some ways we could improve upon, as we've been discussing in the first part of the program. Elise, one of the things that we've both used this expression of pulling kids out, you know, someone who has a learning disability, either language or math or something that requires that they get some special assistance. And what we've been talking about, in your view, the desire to keep kids together and have a more integrated classroom experience, I do want to go ahead and talk about what happens in that other classroom that you pull kids into. What's the quality of the education or the training or that special help that is being given to kids when they are put in that more private or maybe some would say isolated section of the school to get that special training?
Well, you know, there's when we look at general education, we develop teachers certainly to understand children and child development. We also develop teachers to understand content. When we look at special education, teachers have to know disability. They have to understand disability, and they have to understand communication and behavior and communicative intent. And so there's a tremendous amount of expertise of our special ed teachers and our general ed teachers, but it's different expertise. And so what happens in those special classrooms could be anywhere from understanding communication to teaching reading to teaching math. But what we know is it's not magic. I hate to say that, but it's not. And so whatever happens in a special ed classroom or a pull-out room can happen in a general ed room, and all kids can benefit from it. We have to change how we teach. So we can't teach to six kids deep and six kids across. When we think of desks, we have to start teaching in a way where we do 10 or 20 minutes of large group instruction and then break kids up into small groups. And it doesn't have to be ability groups. It can be by how a child learns. So if I'm an experiential learner, then I need to be taught in a way. I might teach algebra concepts differently to an experiential learner than I'm going to teach to someone who's a pretty concrete sequential learner. So how I teach changes, and I can't just teach based on how I learn. And often we all default, I mean, even at the university level, we all default to teaching in our own comfort zone of how we learn. But
we think we turned out pretty well.
Well, not all, but we do. It is our comfort level. And so it is one of the hardest things to do to be a really competent teacher of a broad range of kids. It's not easy. But when you see it, the magic that really happens is in a classroom where kids do not feel segregated from other kids, and yet their individual needs are being met. And that's where the magic actually is. And so we can take what we do in those special rooms and put them and take that magic and bring it back. I don't know if you've ever read Pedagogy of the Oppressed, but Paulo Freire said years ago, if you want to marginalize a group of people, the best way to do it is mystify it as helping. So I wouldn't actually have anything to say to you at all if our achievement scores in kids with disabilities were successful. But we have to own what's going on, and they're not successful. And the difference is when we invert a system to a proactive system where we put the ambulance on top of the cliff, we build an infrastructure where teachers can share their expertise, and it's about building capacity of the adult. Then when we see systems like that and the achievement rate goes up for all kids, then we know we have to actually, first of all, we know we have a resolution. But secondly, we know we can do it. So there's no reason if it can be done in one school, it can't be done someplace else.
Are there ever any cases that can be made for having a separate room, a separate section for kids who do have some more severe disabilities where their experience would be more productive, more helpful than being in a mainstream classroom?
So here's the conversation around that. We have what a lot of people in the field will talk about, and I think parents hear, is the whole continuum of services from the most segregated to the most integrated. And the problem with that continuum, first of all, in this state it was built, it was written in 1974, which was before the federal regs for special ed were even enacted. But, and it's been adapted a little bit since then, but that continuum assumes that we have to group kids by like needs or like disabilities together in order to teach. And the example that we had before, that if you put five kids with severe autism together who have trouble communicating, that it probably isn't the best way. So what we want to do is invert that continuum, the really a vertical continuum, onto a horizontal axis and say, for students with more significant disabilities, they might need more small group instruction during the day, but it doesn't have to be with five other kids that look like them. And they might need more one-on-one instruction. And is there a time for pullout under the umbrella of privacy? Yes. So if I'm a learner and I stutter, do I really want to practice not stuttering in a fifth grade classroom? No, probably not. So should I be offered a place of privacy to do that? Yes. Should it be at a time where I'm not missing my core curriculum? Absolutely, because then I'm going to have to catch up. And so are there times for sensory needs where if I'm a learner with significant disabilities that I might need to have my sensory needs met, and that's not necessary for everyone in the classroom, even though what most general ed teachers are finding is that all kids have sensory needs and that we need to attend to it a little bit more than we do, and that what one student needs maybe somebody else might need as well. That, yes, there are times where the continuum, if it's thrown on its axis by the individual learner, then there are some kids that would have more small group instruction throughout the day and maybe more one-on-one instruction. But it doesn't have to be in a room that nobody else is allowed to come in unless you meet a certain criteria, because that says to other kids, you don't belong. It says to that child, you don't belong, and to other kids, he doesn't belong.
A few weeks ago, I was on campus, and we've had thousands of freshmen coming mm-hmm. in for orientation with their parents mm-hmm. throughout the summer. And I was in a conversation, bumped into a mom, and I think the dad was there, and young woman, and I said, so welcome, where are you from? And, you know, I'm just being friendly administrator, welcoming right. folks to the campus. I said, what are you going to major in? Do you know what you want to do? She said, I want to be a special ed teacher. Mm-hmm. And she was absolutely confident. She had in her mind that she was going to be doing not just general education, not just a high school or grade school or elementary mm-hmm. teacher. I want to be special ed. Is she walking in with the right expectations? Should she? Is there a place to have a curriculum that specifically trains people to, I will use the word, just be a special ed teacher? If, as you're suggesting in our conversation here today, that there needs to be more integration, there needs to be a way of looking at people without necessarily putting them all into silos.
Well, it doesn't negate the need for discipline-specific information. So will we always need special ed teachers? Yes, of course. And so is she being set up? No. But will she learn that her role in an educational environment is going to be to share her expertise, to build the capacity of a general ed teacher, while the general ed teacher is going to assist her with more content. Yes, I mean, a lot of states look at dual certification, general ed and special ed. California has been doing it for decades. But, you know, the greatest concern about dual certification is getting all the courses in and keeping it within 4 years so that it's cost effective for students, et cetera. And it's hard to do. It's really hard to do. So instead of trying to really push the dual certification, even though we do a lot of cross-curriculum between curriculum and instruction and the exceptional ed department on campus, and we do all that, but instead of really pushing dual certification is that they actually have experiences that are merged. So our general ed teacher certification programs spend time with our special ed certification programs, and we come into schools in conjunction with each other in a collaborative manner. And that the understanding is, yes, we have individual expertise, and our responsibility is to collaborate around all kids. And it's a great position to be in. There are even school districts that are starting to change the title of special education. So I brought up Stoughton earlier, and it's one of the districts who changed the actual title of their special ed teachers and their English, as far as ELL teachers, at-risk teachers, have all been changed to learning strategist as far as their title, intentionally so that their job is to work with general ed teachers, certainly with students, but also understanding as they're working with a student, they're modeling to a general ed teacher how to appropriately teach a child with autism, with high behavior needs, with a learning disability. So chances are that student coming in who has a high interest in teaching special ed is going to find out that her job is bigger than she thought it was.
Lots of talk about funding for education. Mm-hmm. Is the money there? Do you think that given all the changes that we've seen here in Wisconsin in particular with the way in which teachers' roles have evolved as a result of change in state law and limits on how much money school districts are allowed to spend, are you optimistic that there still is going to be enough there to make that investment needed to have success in the classroom?
Well, here's money's tight. So, I mean, we'd be kidding if we acted like it wasn't. But what needs to happen in schools and what we've spent a significant amount of time across this state and other states talking about is realigning services. So when you build your infrastructure where there's a vision and the whole entire district is going in that manner, that you can actually do a cross-check with your funds. So school systems in Wisconsin have a 10 fund and a 27 fund. 27 fund is your special ed fund. That you can look at where all the money is being spent and say, literally say, does that increase achievement? And if it does not increase achievement, how can it be reallocated so it does? It costs a lot of money to set up separate programs. It costs a lot of money to bus kids across the city to a separate program. Kids don't want to be on that special bus. It breaks up families. So all of a sudden, three siblings go to the neighborhood school and the student with a disability goes someplace else. We even tell families who belongs and who doesn't. And so the current model is very expensive. That's all there is to it. We don't think making a more asset-based, kind of proactive model is less expensive, but we can reallocate the current resources that we have, and we'll have higher gains in student achievement.
How you use it. Elise, mm-hmm. thanks so much. A fascinating conversation today. Best of luck to you as you continue your work at the university. Elise Vertura, Associate Professor of Exceptional Education, also the Chair of the Department of Exceptional Ed, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week at the same time. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.